Welcome to Come Inside. Today's guest is Rais Bouillon. He is a survivor of a hate crime committed in retaliation for September 11th by a white supremacist. When you hear his story and you hear about the sympathy, the empathy, and the compassion that this one individual can have for the person who tried to take their life, it is so emotional to listen to. This is easily my favorite episode of the podcast so far, and that's why I've kept it until now. This is a guy who now runs an organization called World Without Hate, and I will put a link to his website in the description of this episode. This is the last episode of season one of the podcast series. So thank you to everyone who listened. And season two will be out soon. I'm starting to record season two very shortly. But on top of that, I'm about to start production on a brand new podcast series. So here it is, episode 8 with Rais Bouillon. Enjoy. Obviously, I know about the attack that happened on you in 2001 after 9/11. This is a heavy question to get into straight away, I know. But I want to kind of understand how you were able to make sense of that attack.
Well, it did not make any sense in the beginning. And yeah. How could it?
Yeah.
It is not something like somebody said something nasty to my face or something, you know, somebody stole something from me. It was someone shot me in the face from point blank range for no reason other than my physical appearance and my faith. And it was beyond fathomable when the wound was fresh and emotions are raw. But, you know, in the course of time, when my healing process began, as I grew mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, I started analyzing the whole situation. And the more I learned about my attacker, starting from his childhood, it really helped me to understand why he did what he did. And his ignorance combined with hate and drug addiction triggered him to stereotype all Muslims as terrorists. He did not see me as an individual person who had nothing to do with 9/11. Rather, he saw me as a part of the group that he hated the most. And he was fixated, like many people, watching the same video footage, the planes hitting the Twin Towers, listening leaders and politicians blaming Muslims for 9/11. And he snapped and took up arms against innocent human beings. At the end, he lost his life along with his two victims and brought tremendous pain and suffering, not only to those victims' families, but also to his own. I mean, I learned at a very young age that hate is like fire. And when a house catches fire, it may burn others around it, if not extinguished quickly. And it started making sense to me that my house caught fire because of the house next to me caught fire and was not extinguished properly in time. And I paid for someone else's crime. So, you know, when I give a deep dive and thought about, you know, the whole situation, it started making sense slowly to me. And it helped me to move forward as well.
Okay. Do you think the media coverage of 9/11 had something to do with him snapping, like the way that the media still do it today? You know, we saw what has just happened in New Zealand. It was actually an Australian man, a terrorist is what I would call him. For some reason, we in Australia are reporting it as just an alleged gunman, but he wasn't. He was a terrorist and he killed Muslims in a mosque in, you know, the most vulnerable position. So we're still not reporting things properly. Do you think that the media, especially back then, it was a lot more ignorant, the way they were reporting it, because it did feel very much like, oh, all Muslims are like terrorists. That was just the way that it was.
Well, it did. The media did not help at that situation. Yeah. They kept showing the same footage of the planes hitting the Twin Towers and, you know, invited people to come to the, you know, media and sharing their thoughts and ideas. And almost everyone started blaming Muslims for 9/11. And it was a rare, hardly anybody talked good about Islam and Muslim at that time. It was kind of like a festival. You come and you start, you know, spewing hate and violence against the Muslims and Islam. It was a, you know, free pass, whoever wanted to say anything nasty. I'm not blaming everyone, but I'm saying that majority of the, you know, people who had chance to come to media did not really try to unite people, bring people together after the terrible incident. They were looking for some sorts of, you know, revenge. And the 9/11 gave the path to express what they actually possess inside. And I mean, my attacker, he said repeatedly that watching the same video clips again and again in the different media, and he snapped. He said he was not a serial killer, he was not a murderer, and he would never even kill anyone. But you know, seeing the same thing again and again, he snapped, and he said that his country was under attack by foreigners, especially people from Middle East, and it was wartime. So he wanted to behave that way people behave in war zone. And that's why, you know, he took up arms. And after his arrest, he told the news media that what he did, most Americans wanted to do, they just did not have the guts. He blamed all Muslims for 9/11. And he said he was a true American. He was the patriot, and he should have been given medal for his action.
Wow. I mean, how, when you hear that, especially back then, that must have been extremely hard to process.
It was. And again, you know, it showed me that the level of ignorance, the level of intolerance and hatred, he had nothing to do with Muslims. He never even met a Muslim. He never even, you know, went out of his the area he was born, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. But then, you know, hearing about the Muslims and the faith Islam from a very limited source right after 9/11, his level of ignorance actually increased, because he learned only bad things about Muslims and Islam after 9/11 terrorist attack. And in his mind, all Muslims are bad and they're terrorists. And he did the right thing in his point of view. But until I started a campaign to try to save his life from Texas death row, only that his views, thoughts started changing about Muslims and Islam.
Yeah, that's amazing. I definitely want to get into that, because I find that really intriguing. But have you always been just a really forgiving person? Because essentially you did forgive him, didn't you?
Yes, I forgave him, and I also ran an international campaign to try to save his life. And
yes,
I learned about forgiveness at a very young age from my parents, from my Islamic faith, and unbelievably from a poor little man who came begging at our door. And he sang the powerful story of Prophet, you know, Joseph. Yep. In Islam, we call him Yusuf, peace be upon him. That deeply touched me, that how his brothers tried to kill him, and he was able to forgive them not only, but also he invited them and, build a new life with his brothers. So, you know, it really wow, touched me pretty deeply. And at a pretty young age, I learned from my mother, and she said that, always put a zipper on my mouth once I was hurt and angry.
Okay.
That would not only de-escalate the situation, but also would give me an opportunity to respond better. And revenge was never an option. Either be kind or forgive, or leave it up to God. If you struggle to show mercy, most of the time I followed the first option. But there were times when I had to leave the matter in God's hands.
So Mark Stroman was his name, the guy who, you know, eventually he got the death penalty and has been executed. I don't want to kind of rehash anything that's not going to sit well with you, but are you able to kind of talk about what happened in that moment? I know he shot you in the face, but I think I've read somewhere in your story that you told him he can take whatever he wants or something, and he still pulled the trigger.
Right. As soon as he walked in the gas station where I was working with a sort of double-barrel shotgun pointing at my face, wearing a bandana and a sunglasses and a baseball cap, having been robbed before in that gas station, I thought it would be another robbery. So I opened the cash register and offered him money. Instead of taking it, his gaze remained fixed, and he asked me, "Where are you from?" And before I could say anything more than, "Excuse me," he pulled the trigger from point blank range.
Okay. You were very lucky to survive, right?
I was extremely fortunate. He ended up two other men from South Asia as a part of his 9/11 retaliation shooting spree. And I was shot from point blank range with a double barrel shotgun. But I luckily survived. But as a result of the shooting, I underwent several eye surgeries. And unfortunately, though, I end up losing sight in one eye. The right side of my face and his skull remains peppered with more than 36 bullet fragments. And I lost my home, my job, sense of security, and my fiance, but gained more than $60,000 in medical bills.
And wow.
When I reached out to the Red Cross for help, they told me I was only qualified for 1 week's worth of groceries. And when my father heard what happened to me, he suffered a stroke, but thankfully survived. And I would say there's not a single day that goes by that I'm not reminded of this painful tragedy. But I continue to make peace with my pain, and that has helped me to thrive.
Do you have a lot of health concerns now because of that? Like, there must be a flow-on effect. Obviously, you said you've lost sight in one of your eyes. Is your hearing, does your hearing still work in both ears? I mean, there must be more happening. You've probably got PTSD, maybe. I'm not sure.
No, of course. It created so much fear. And right after that incident happened to me, I would not go out of my home after this incident happened to me. I would be extremely, afraid to see people with tattoo and, bald-headed guys. Terrified events looking at them. And it really killed me mentally and psychologically. And I was struggling to lead a normal life. And but because of that fear, I could not go outside. I could not lead a normal life. And I kept praying, "God, that you saved me. You saved my life. So now help me to overcome this fear." And, then I realized that prayer is not everything. I have to also take action while I'm praying. So I end up working at a restaurant as a waiter, and where within a few weeks after I started working there, I received a guest, three guys and one girl, three all full of tattoos. And I freaked out. I thought maybe they are here to ensure that I work here, and then maybe later on they will take revenge. They will try to kill me. And I even didn't go to say hello to them. I was crying in the back of the kitchen, and then my manager found me, and he came and asked me, "You should be talking to your guests right now. Why are you here? And you are crying?" So I got the opportunity to explain my situation, even though I never told my story to anyone at the restaurant. So the manager actually helped me. He said, "Come on with me." He took me to the guest, and he introduced himself. It was a very interesting experience as well. He is an African American. And I'm brown skin. So he put his black face next to my brown face, and he told the guest, "Gentlemen, my name is Pete, and this is my twin, Repeat. And we are here to serve you. And Repeat is your front server, and I'm your backup. If Repeat makes any mistake, don't yell at him. Call me. I will take care of you." And with that light jokes, the people who I was afraid of sitting in front of me started smiling and looking at me, and I saw them as a human being. I did not see them as a threat, even though I was scared. But that few moments really helped me to overcome the fear for the moment, and I was able to talk to them in a human capacity, and they asked me all kinds of questions. I served them very well. They gave me a very good tip and said, once you're going to come back, we'll ask for you repeat, not your twin brother, Pete. And that experience, you know, helped me slowly overcome the fear of people with tattoo and bald-headed guys. And I thought, well, they were just normal, simple human beings. And I was afraid for no reason because of my own fear. So slowly I was able to overcome the fear and the trauma I developed from this shooting incident. But it took little time. And still, you know, it comes back when there's a shooting incident happen here and there all over the world.
Yeah,
it brings the trauma again that some human beings, you know, became victims or they lost their lives. Family members are going through tragedy, trauma. I wish nothing that happens anymore, but we're living in a world full of ignorance and violence.
Yeah, that's very true. Was Mark Strowman, in your opinion, was he rehabilitated? You obviously fought for him. So maybe we should start with that. So you fought for him to be taken off death row. So maybe we'll start there instead. Why?
Right.
Why did you fight so hard? When I first read that, I was like, wow. I was trying to think about if I was in that position, would I be able to do that? And I'm against the death penalty, but it was like that must have just taken so much self-discovery and everything to be able to do that.
Well, that is the power of forgiveness. You know, once you forgive someone, you don't want to see them, you know, going through pain and suffering because you forgave them. And I suffered terribly and lost a tremendous amount, but I did not see any value in him suffering as well. I was able to forgive him when I got my life back as a part of my deathbed promise to God that if you let me live, I would do good things with my life. I would dedicate my life for the poor, needy, and deprived all over the world. But do not take me to it. And it was a strong promise to God. So when I got my life back, I remember what my parents taught me, that, you know, thoughts of revenge, violence is never an option. I should, you know, forgive and move forward. And if I struggle to show mercy, at least I would leave things up to God and to the justice system, but, you know, never seek revenge. So I did not think about my attacker anymore. I started rebuilding my life slowly, working in restaurants, going back to school. And, you know, lots of loving, kind, and caring Americans, they came forward to help me. The doctor who treated me before receiving assurance how he would be paid, he performed surgeries one after another one. And a man from the local mosque gave me scholarship to go to school. An Air Force veteran gave me his extra car. This was the America that, you know, loving, caring, warm, hospitable, generous, that I heard so much about growing. And with the mercy of God and the help of loving and kind, caring Americans, I was eventually able to get my life back on track. And I was extremely fortunate to go for a religious pilgrimage to Mecca with my mother in 2009. And it was in Mecca where I deeply realized that hate and revenge may bring temporary satisfaction, but does not bring solution or peace to any situation. They only bring more disaster and misery. And I kept thinking about my shooting incident, and I thought about my shooter, Mark Strowman, sitting in death row waiting to die. And I realized his life was irrevocably changed because of the shooting, just as mine had. And I truly believe that his execution will not eradicate hate and violence from this world. We would simply lose another human life without dealing with the root cause. I saw him as a human being like me, not as a killer. I began to see him as a victim as well. And I truly believe if he was given a chance to live, even behind bars, he might be able to become a better person and contribute to society in a positive way. And when I was in Mecca, I gave a deep dive, you know, kept thinking about the purpose of life, where we came from, why we are here, and where do we go once we close our eyes. So I spent a month praying 14 to 15 hours per day and asking God for guidance, for forgiveness for myself, and the strength to keep my promise that I had in my deathbed. And I learned about, you know, many powerful verses in the Quran, like, for example, chapter 5, verse 32, where it says very clearly that saving a life is like saving the entire mankind, and taking a life is like taking the entire mankind. I was extremely inspired, you know, by this verse of the Holy Quran, and I felt that my forgiveness was not enough. I had to do more to save the life of my attacker so that, you know, he can contribute to society and help others like him who are full of ignorance and intolerance and violence. So when I came, I would say that my upbringing, my faith, and all the powerful stories about mercy and forgiveness I learned in my childhood actually gave me the strength and courage not only to forgive my attacker, but also to run a campaign to save the life of the man who tried to end mine. And with the support of Amnesty International, I started, you know, lobbying to save the life of my attacker. And working with a nonprofit called Reprieve from London, we took our campaign to the European Union and German parliaments, and as well as the headquarters of Lundbeck, the lethal injection manufacturer in Denmark. And we convinced them to write a letter to the governor of Texas not to use their product to kill human beings. And at the end of the visit, end of 2011, Lundbeck also announced that they would stop supplying this drug to the U.S. prisons that carry out executions. And I also went to the U.S. Supreme Court asking for clemency for my attacker.
I mean, it's one of I just find that amazing, that forgiveness, that, I mean, it's just such a nice way of looking at it, especially when you look at the state of the world. If only a lot more people thought like that. And hopefully one day we will get there. I'm wondering, did Mark Stroman ever apologize to you, ever show any regret or anything?
No, he did not. And I never even expected, you know, before even running the campaign or even, you know, during or after, I never expect that he would write a letter or he would say publicly he apologized. Would have been nice to hear back from him, but I was told once the trial was over and he was given death penalty that I should not make any attempt to contact him. And, you know, I was new to this country and didn't have much knowledge about the justice system. So I did not make any effort to reach out to him. But when I started my campaign, his lawyer told him that one of your victims is running a campaign to save your life. And I was told that he was stunned and he was deeply moved by the efforts that a group of people in the free world, Muslims, Jews, Christians, Hindus, you know, atheists, came together and supporting my campaign to take him removed from death row. He said he was stunned, and this was not something he expected from a Muslim. And then he started talking about world peace, justice, mercy, and he condemned his own acts of violence and thanked the entire Muslim community and took responsibility for his crime. And he started giving lot of interviews with the national and international media. And in a statement, he said this: in a free world, I was free, but I was locked up in a prison inside myself because of the hate I carried in my heart. It is due to racist message of forgiveness. I am more content now than I have ever been before. Definitely. He said that my stepfather taught me some lessons that I should have never learned. It has taken me for too long to unlearn some of them, and I'm still working on some of them. I don't know who your parents were, but it is obvious they are wonderful people to lead you to act this way to someone you have every right to hate. It's a very powerful message if you think, and my parents for raising me well, which also shows that he had a deep wound in his heart, that he did not have a loving and kind parent the way I had. Many of us, you know, have a loving and kind parents, and he grew up without that. And it shows that there was a deep wound in his heart.
Did you go to his execution?
No, I did not. I was fighting in the court until the last moment. His execution was scheduled at 6 p.m., and I was in the courtroom until 8 p.m. fighting to stop it. And but I was able to talk to him on the same day. He was sitting next to execution chamber. And it was a very emotional conversation because I wanted to meet him in person. I wanted to talk to him as a human being, not as a as my would-be killer. But my request was turned down again and again by the prison system and the justice system. But I was able to talk to him for a few seconds before he was executed. And I mean, what can you tell to a person who is about to be executed? There's not much you really can say.
No.
And but I wanted to let him know. I wanted to tell him that what he heard from others, that his victims forgave him, and you know, I never hated him. So I wanted to make sure that he heard this from me directly. So when he came on the phone, I told him that, Mark, you should know that I never hated you and I forgave you. And he said, I never expected this from you. Thank you so much. I love you, bro. And when he said that, the last two words, love and bro, I couldn't hold my tears right there. I started crying. And I kept thinking, why couldn't you see me as your brother 9 years ago?
Yeah.
Instead of pulling the trigger, I was terrified seeing you about to pull the trigger. You could have asked me something different. Are you afraid? Because 9/11 happened, a lot of people are being beaten up, killed. What can I do, my brother? But you didn't, your heart was filled with ignorance, hate, and intolerance that day. And you were the same person 9 years after, but that hate and intolerance, ignorance is gone out of your heart. Because of that, you could see me as your brother today. But it's too late. I was about to go to court to testify why it is important to stop this execution. And you were sitting next to your execution chamber waiting for this trial to be ended. It was very emotional. I felt extremely, you know, helpless at that moment that, you know, beside testifying, I didn't know what else I could do to save a human life. I did not see him as my attacker. I did not see him as a white man. I did not see him as a Christian. I saw him as a human being like me who was about to lose his life.
Yeah. Do you know what he obviously he did kill two other men? Do you know what their families felt about you trying to get him off death row? Did they agree with that? Did they not agree with that? Are you aware?
Yes. What I did before I started the campaign and before made it public, I reached out to them because I wanted to ensure that I speak with them first, get their opinion, make sure that their opinions were respected, and also share my thoughts and and ideas why I was doing this or why I was about to start this campaign. So I had the opportunity to meet both families and explain my thoughts and ideas, but I kept a very respectful conversation as well, not instead of pushing them. And they took time. It was a very emotional and sensitive conversation because, you know, in their case, they lost their husbands, they lost their fathers, and it wasn't an easy conversation. But I kept it open and I said, I would respect whatever, opinion you share with me. Totally is up to you. But they took time and they came back and they both forgave Mark. Matter of fact, one of the families, they even, came forward and joined my campaign, took part in every media event, press conference. They even went to the court.
Wow, I can't even imagine doing that. You now have an organization called World Without Hate. What led to you starting that? Did it come from your journey of being a victim to then, did you start this before you started your campaign to get him off death row?
Well, the nonprofit came into establishment later. So I would say this. First, I set up the campaign. And later when, I was unsuccessful to save my attacker's life, I didn't want to stop there. Once the hearing was over, when the judge told me that there is nothing I can do, I had to stop this hearing because of the highest court from the criminal side asked me to stop this hearing. So I asked my attorney what is next, and my attorney told me there is nothing left. It is already 8 p.m. Everything is closed, and he needs to go follow the procedure to be executed today. And I couldn't believe that there was nothing we could do at that moment. So I said, there has to be something as a workaround. And he said, no, there's nothing. So once we were about to leave the courtroom, the judge came back and tapped me on my shoulder and said, young man, you had a pretty strong case. And what you have been doing, it is very important for this world. So keep doing what you have been doing. World needs a person like you. And even though I was sad, I was angry at that moment, but it gave me such a comfort that, as a judge, he didn't have to come and talk to me once the hearing was over, but he must have felt something in his heart. That's why he came back. Even though I was extremely upset, but I told myself that I'm not quitting this work. I would, go and do whatever I can to help others like him. So and also during the campaign, I received tremendous positive support and energy from all over the world. And that gave me the inspiration to establish my nonprofit, World Without Hate, to honor my deathbed wish, and also to continue my journey to inspire people to be more compassionate, empathetic, forgiving, understanding, and accepting. And that's where I started the nonprofit, to help people like Mark in the free world so that they don't end up in a situation like him.
Was it hard hearing from the judge that you had a strong case, but yet he was still going to be executed?
Well, we were fighting in a civil court, and he received his death penalty from the criminal side of the justice system.
Yep.
And the last moment, a verdict came from the highest court from the criminal division. And this is something in our justice system, that a higher court from one side can stop hearing at a lower court on the other side. If we had time, we could have appealed to a higher court. But since it was already 8 p.m., we didn't have that opportunity. But it was very comforting that when the judge came and talked to me and said, the way I testified and I talked about why it was so important to keep a human being alive behind bars, so that people can learn from his mistakes and he would get a second chance. Like many of us, once we make a mistake, we also ask for a second chance. He would get a second chance, and that might help him to be a better human being and contribute to society in a positive way. It was very powerful to hear back from the judge, and when he told me that, this world needs more people like you, keep up the great work. It was very, very comforting at that moment.
Mark Stroman had a daughter, right? Is that right that he had a daughter?
He has three daughters and one son.
He's got four kids. Have you ever spoken to them, met with them face to face? Are you interested in doing that if you haven't?
I did that. Matter of fact, I would say this is the power of forgiving, of mercy and empathy. Not only transformed Mark, but it also deeply touched his family members who came forward to meet me later after Mark was executed. And when I met his daughter, Amber, I told her that you lost your father, but you gained an uncle. And if there's anything I can do within my capacity to help you and your other siblings, my door is always open. Reach out to me. I'm here to help as much as I can. I kept my promise to support her as much as I could. And his son was in prison when Mark was executed. But when he came out of prison in 2013, he sent me a big thank you note. And I offered him lunch get together if he ever comes to Dallas. And I did not hear back from him in next 3 months. And then I received one day one Facebook message that he had enough time to talk, but he cannot eat due to some physical issues. So I was curious to know more about him. Then I found out that he had a car accident, pretty bad car accident, where he almost lost his life. So I went to see him in the hospital, and he was extremely moved again. He did not believe that I would actually go to see him in the hospital. And I did it because they had nothing to do with their father's crime. They should not be paying for their father's crime, which I knew very well because I paid for someone else's crime. So I felt that they should never be blamed for their father's crime. So I went to see him, and he told me that when I get cured, would you allow me to join your work? I would like to work with you and tell my story to the younger generation in hopes of inspiring them that they should not follow the path that I walked on, which ultimately dropped me out of school and end up in prison. And I had a friend with me. He tapped on my shoulder. He said, "Race, this is what exactly you wanted to do with his father. And now his son, without being asked, wants to join your work. Your mission is accomplished." I said, "Not yet. It's just, you know, energize the base again when young people like Mark Sine, you know, interested to come and help other young people not to follow his path. There's a lot of work needs to be done, but I'm glad that, you know, he saw the value, importance getting involved with this kind of work." So I kept in touch. Unfortunately, Mark Sine went back to prison for another charge, you know, that broke my heart. I wanted to fight the case when he reached out to me, but it was a pretty tough case, no way to win. So he took a plea, but he asked me that he would take the plea if I promised I would go to his parole hearing when he's eligible. And I said I would do that if I stay alive. And I kept my promise when he was eligible for parole in 2016. But in the U.S., it is extremely hard to, you know, get parole in your first hearing. It's very unlikely.
Yeah.
And he did.
Wow.
With him, he's in prison right now.
Okay. That's extremely powerful from you telling the daughter that, you know, you've lost a father, but you've gained an uncle, and just hearing you talk about this family. And like you say, they aren't responsible at all, but I'm sure it could maybe be hard for some people to look at them and not see them as this extension of their father and then view that in a negative way. So I find that, I actually find that quite emotional listening to you talk about it, but it makes sense in a way. Do you actually think that a world without hate is possible? Like, is there something that we should be doing in our everyday life? I know, obviously, I agree, people need to learn the difference between empathy and sympathy. They need to learn to be more compassionate and accepting, all the, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Is there anything else that you would advise that you think could help?
Well, a world, we must remember that a world without hate cannot be achieved unless a world without hate first achieved in our hearts and minds.
Yeah.
And I believe one way to do this is to educate our young people and reminding one another that everyone deserves to be treated equally as humans first, regardless of race, religion, skin color, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, and ethnic or cultural background.
Yeah.
We must teach our children giving empathy, kindness, mercy, forgiveness before they're exposed to racism, ignorance, intolerance, hate, and violence. If you do that, I believe that one day we will be living in a world where there will be less violence, less victims, and less hate.
I can see that. I hope that happens. I really do. And I agree. It's about educating the youth and trying to get rid of some of this ignorance in the world. It's very scary. I mean, I find it quite scary. And I know talking about 9/11 before, you're talking about the planes crashing into the Twin Towers. I was 12 years old. I still remember seeing it. Like, it's an image that I've never been able to get out of my head because it was replayed so often. It is just so horrible. But I've never in my life blamed the Muslim community. But I have friends that are Muslim, and I know even at a young age, being 12 years old when that happened, people started picking on friends that I had that were Muslim at school. And it was just this ignorance that they were hearing from their parents. So it is very scary, and we need to do more. I absolutely agree. Do you think that educating the youth and just educating people in general would really help deter people away from a life of crime?
Well, I would say that, you know, in order to deter people from a life of crime, we must start from the beginning by ensuring a safe and secure upbringing for all children, providing equal access to education, proper mental health care, emotional support, opportunities for success, and the elimination of the root causes of poverty, racism, drug abuse, and political, economical, religious, judicial, and systematic suppression. Yep. The bottom line is, in order to combat hate crime, intolerance, bigotry, and violence, we need to understand its root causes. We must identify what triggers an individual to commit a crime, which varies person to person, situation to situation. So if you focus on the root causes instead of tackling the symptoms, I think we have a very good chance that we'll be able to live in a better world, live in a society less intolerance, less misunderstanding, fear, and ignorance.
Do you think that would also help if we did that with people that are already in prison? If we actually found out what the root cause was, we could actually help rehabilitate them. Like, even if they're never going to be a chance of being released, I personally believe that we should still be trying to rehabilitate them so that they can understand what they've done and make peace with it themselves.
Yes, I do believe. And I would say that, you know, I believe in criminal rehabilitation. I believe that people deserve a second chance, because we all make mistakes, and there should be opportunities available to learn and grow and contribute to society. We must remember one thing, that no one is born a criminal. No one is born to hate or to be violent. People are either taught to hate or go through challenges in their lives, desensitizing them to others' right to life, liberty, happiness, and freedom. I would say that, you know, that retribution is needed. Of course, it is needed to maintain justice, law, and order in society.
Yep.
However, it does not have to destroy a person's life or their family. Rather, the criminal justice system should serve to repair, rehabilitate, and give perpetrators a second chance to become better human beings, and provide an opportunity for them to contribute to society so that others can learn from their mistakes.
Yep.
I personally believe that justice is truly served if it is tempered with mercy. And about the people in the prison, I would say this, that everyone has value and power to make a difference regardless of who they are or where they are. The best way to rehabilitate a person is to give him or her hope for a better tomorrow and a purpose in life, providing access to education that can help them to cultivate their inner strength, boost their morals, open their hearts and minds, and change their views and thoughts. Because a lot of people are locked up in prison for years, and they have maximum time to think through what they did, how they end up in prison, and how they can do good once they are out in the free world. And I would say that the guidance also that can lead to peace and understanding of their own situation. When they're locked up, people need guidance. Otherwise, you know, you are in the same situation where you are outside and inside. Unless the proper guidance, proper opportunity, there will be less room for them to make change in their thoughts, ideas, and views. So I would go back to the point that guidance that can lead to peace and understanding of their own situation, which can inspire them to guide others in the free world so that they can learn from their experience.
Yep.
Providing them with opportunity to contribute even from behind bars so that they feel that they are valued and contributing to society in a positive, selfless, and a valuable way.
Okay. Do you think the death penalty just needs to be scrapped? It's not a deterrent. Just get rid of it.
Well, there are, you know, all kinds of thoughts on both sides, for and against. So I would say this, that the death penalty is actually a cruel and inhuman punishment designed as a deterrent to save human lives, but throughout history is being widely used as a tool to suppress political opponents, poor and helpless human beings. I would say this, that human life is very precious. And instead of taking a life, if we dedicate more resources and efforts to help people respect each other's humanity and dignity and improve the circumstances that push people to commit violent crimes, that there will be less bloodshed in the world. There will be less, you know, death penalty. There will be less killing in the world. I would say that I agree that a lot of people say death penalty is not a deterrent. I agree with the statement because in research, it shows that the murder rate in a state that do not have death penalty is constantly lower than in states with the death penalty.
Yeah, I saw that recently and I was like, that to me was just proof enough that it isn't a deterrent.
It's not, but at the same time, there are arguments on both sides. I would say this also, that according to a new study published in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology, 88% of America's top criminologists do not believe that death penalty acts as a deterrent to homicide.
Yeah.
Similarly, 87% of the expert criminologists believe that abolition of death penalty would not have any significant effect on murder rate. And yeah, in addition, huge. It's huge. And in addition to that, 75% of the respondents agree that debates about the death penalty distract Congress and state legislatures from focusing on real solutions to crime problems and violence.
Those statistics are huge. I hope they get rid of the death penalty. I've been lucky enough in Australia that we haven't had the death penalty in my lifetime. I know there are like certain crimes and you go, oh, just kill the person, you know, like they just deserve to die. But, you know, that might be the initial reaction to a really heinous crime, but it doesn't serve a purpose. I think I was reading the other day there are over 20,000 people on death row around the world. It's a lot.
It's a lot. And unfortunately, it could be more because there are some countries that do not share their data.
Yeah, well, that was part of the thing as well. It was saying it's probably a lot bigger than this. Yeah.
Right.
Which is just scary. Thank you so much for your time. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to mention or say.
Well, one thing, you know, if I may say at the end that, you know, what are the simple and easy thing we can do makes positive to make social impact, to bring change. And this is one of my favorite quote. I use it everywhere I go, that we need to find ways to make each other respectfully uncomfortable as we pursue common good and positive social change. We have to talk about the issues that is plaguing our families, our society, instead of ignoring them. Until we talk about those issues respectfully, we would never be able to come up with the solutions. And we would still be living, facing those challenges in our society. So the best thing is, let's acknowledge those issues and have a respectful conversation, even though we may not feel comfortable, but let's do it and listen respectfully and also talk respectfully. And that may help us to find the solutions.
That's brilliant. I can't think of a better way to finish this than that. All right. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. So until next time, be the change the world needs. But for now, school's out. Class dismissed.